In commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, probably the most transformative moment in 20th century history,
we interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin from Washington, D.C. According to an unconfirmed report received at the Hawaiian governor's office, at 7:55 this morning, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu. This is not a joke. This is the real McCoy. Wave after wave of bombers streamed through the clouded sky from the southwest and flung their missiles on a city resting in peaceful Sabbath calm. We will bring you more updates as we receive them. Now back to our regular programming.
The island of Oahu will be hosting 11 days of events and memorials. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer reporting from Oahu. Come along and join me for a fascinating conversation with four-star Admiral Thomas Fargo, the retired commander of the Pacific Fleet. Today, he's chairman of the Hawaii Governor's Pearl Harbor 75th Anniversary Committee. Admiral Fargo shares insights about the 41 planned commemorative events at Pearl Harbor and around the island of Oahu. He also shares fascinating personal insights about World War II and recollections from his illustrious naval career.
Members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Admiral Thomas Fargo.
Good to have you out here in Hawaii.
As you know, the reason that we got together has everything to do with Pearl Harbor, with December 7th, 1941, and this being the 75th anniversary. I understand you're intimately involved in that project.
Well, yes, I am. The governor put together a committee to coordinate all of the different events for the 75th commemoration of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and I was asked to chair that committee, so that's how I got involved. But I've been living here in Hawaii for the past 16 years, my last 6 years of military service, and then the 11 years that have followed that. And so I spent a lot of time with the community, obviously a lot of time still with the current military leadership, as well as with all the historic attractions here at Pearl Harbor. You have to understand, I spent almost my entire career in the Pacific, with the exception of the shore duty tours in Washington, D.C. So, you know, World War II and the Pacific are so closely entwined in terms of the history that at every turn you had a flavor for the kinds of, for example, amphibious operations that occurred across the Pacific. As you traveled through the Pacific, you would see all of these different historical sites, whether it's Tarawa and Peleliu or Iwo Jima, that were a huge part of our history. And I would tell you, the first day I walked into my quarters in October of 1999, that house was the same house that Admiral Nimitz occupied and lived in throughout World War II. And right on the desk as you walked in to those quarters was his autobiography. And so you can imagine the first thing that you read that first week in the job, if you hadn't already, was Nimitz's autobiography. So you can't travel anywhere in Hawaii or the Western Pacific where you aren't constantly reminded of this very important part of our nation's history.
It is fascinating how there is even that palpable visual symbolic legacy that lives on the structures, Ford Island, Pearl Harbor itself. It's in many ways very unchanged since World War II.
No, that's absolutely true, and you're going to see a lot of it during your visit here. But it's also the lessons of World War II. As I said, when you walk into Nimitz's home or you walk into his old headquarters down at Pearl Harbor, I mean, you have to think, you know, what it was like. You know, 10 days after the attack, when President Roosevelt gave him his orders to go to Hawaii, to go to Pearl Harbor, and take command of what was a fleet that had been devastated by those attacks. And I remember reading some of what he wrote about that period of time. And he said very clearly, you know, the first 2 months after he took command, things only got worse. It was a very confusing and chaotic period of time as the Japanese appeared to actually make further gains after Pearl Harbor. And it wasn't really until Coral Sea, and then especially Midway in June of 1942, where the tide started to turn.
And if you think about it, Midway, there was some definite luck involved.
There's a lot of luck involved. As you know, they were very fortunate to catch the Japanese in a situation where they were rearming. It could have come out differently, but I think leadership at that point in time recognized that they had to take a measured risk if they were going to turn this thing around. But, you know, there were lots of lessons from that period of time. As a submariner, one of the lessons, and you see it in some of the movies made about Pearl Harbor, you know, the submarine force had a torpedo problem. And you've probably seen it, you know, the scenes where, you know, torpedoes were bouncing off the hulls of Japanese ships because the fuses weren't detonating. And, you know, those kinds of lessons were things that stuck with us throughout our careers. I can remember my boss, who was the head of the submarine force at the time, when we were bringing on the new Mark 48 torpedo, you know, said, I'm not going to be the guy that introduces a set of torpedoes that have problems like we did in World War II. So the lessons of World War II are something that are inculcated in you from the early days at the Naval Academy and throughout your career.
Let's jump forward in time to here today, Pearl Harbor, in the anniversary, the celebration of the 75th. Tell us about what you plan.
To kind of set this in context, we have to remember this is probably the last big commemoration or opportunity to honor these folks. If you were a young sailor on December 7th, 1941, let's say you were 18 years old then, you will be 93 this December 7th. So this is probably our most important opportunity.
And you've gone to great lengths to reach out and to invite all the vets that you can find anywhere to come, correct?
That's correct. There are 5 Arizona survivors right now. Another Arizona survivor passed away not too long ago. We expect probably 150 Pearl Harbor survivors, and then, of course, there'll be a large number of World War II survivors that will be in attendance. What we've tried to do is lay out a series of events that recognizes all of these different stakeholder groups. And I mentioned the Arizona survivors, the Pearl Harbor survivors, the World War II survivors, but there's also the veterans of almost 7 decades of military service since World War II, and the current active duty service members and the Guard and Reserve that we want to recognize in a similar fashion. So when I talk about the events, you'll see that different events are pointed towards different audiences.
Give us an overview of some of the specific events that you have planned.
Let me hit some of the high points. On Saturday night, December 3rd, the Pacific Aviation Museum is going to have their annual event, but this year it will be, of course, at a level that has not been touched previously in any of their previous events. The Pacific Aviation Museum, of course, is relatively new, but it's a fabulous example of the kinds of aviation capability that both belonged to the United States and Japan during that era. So that'll occur on Saturday. On Sunday, we're going to put together an opening of a new Remember Pearl Harbor documentary film, and that'll also be at the Pacific Aviation Museum. On Monday, we're going to recognize one of those very special groups, and that's the Americans of Japanese ancestry and descent that fought for some very special organizations, the 442nd, the 100th Infantry Battalion, the Military Intelligence Group, and those units were the most decorated within the nation for their action in Europe, in a large number of Medal of Honor winners. So we're going to have a luncheon.
And you're going to have 442nd guys here.
Precisely, because a lot of them, of course, retired here in Hawaii and their families. So it'll be probably 650 folks, and we'll do that at the Hawaii Convention Center. But that'll be a tribute to those organizations, and they are very special. Of course, our late Senator Dan Inouye was a member of the 442.
As I remember, he lost an arm, right?
He lost an arm and was a Medal of Honor recipient.
Some of the other events that you have planned.
So let's move to Tuesday. Tuesday, we're going to have a large tribute at the Hilton Hawaiian Village that will recognize all of the Pearl Harbor survivors. We expect about 1,000 people. That will be a night of remembrance and tribute and a chance to kind of reflect on all that they accomplished. The next day, December 7th, will be the annual ceremony at the Arizona Memorial that both the Navy and the Park Service put on each year. And of course, that'll start early in the morning at the exact time of the attack. We'll reflect on that tragic event. And we expect about 4,000 people will attend it at what we call Kilo Pier. It's a site on the base that overlooks the Arizona Memorial. But more than just that, we're going to stream the video from that not only throughout Hawaii, but throughout the country. So we'll have overflow folks at the Arizona Memorial Visitors Center. We're going to stream this to Times Square, to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., and there's a number of other organizations, too, that will provide the streaming video.
Probably New Orleans.
New Orleans, the World War II Museum in New Orleans, probably the Navy Memorial on Pennsylvania Avenue. But we think it's important that we share this and get it to the largest possible audience.
Very powerful. So there's more.
There is more. You know, we're trying to do some things, as we talked about, for the active duty folks, too. And Fox Sports is going to sponsor the second Pearl Harbor Invitation. And they're going to do it at the old Block Arena. Block Arena was the site where Elvis Presley did the concert to raise money for the Arizona Memorial. So we've got some great basketball teams coming out, Hawaii and Cal and Seton Hall and Princeton. We did it last year, and of course, one of the teams that went to this tournament ended up winning the NCAA championship. So it'll be a great event, and Fox Sports has been a fabulous supporter. The week culminates, actually, in two very significant events. One is a benefit concert that Garth Brooks is going to put on that Saturday night, the 10th. And then, of course, the Honolulu Marathon starts the next morning, early. So my guess is some people go to the concert and just stay up and run the marathon.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be a couple of those. Any other important events that you have scheduled?
You know, there's a lot of different activities. There's a ceremony called the Blackened Canteen that is one that we do to recognize our history and the manner in which the U.S. and Japan have become allies and friends. You know, that's a very emotional event. But each of the historic sites, the USS Missouri, the Bowfin, which was a World War II submarine, as I've already mentioned, the Pacific Aviation Museum, and I've already mentioned Arizona, but there are other memorials too, the Utah Memorial, the USS Oklahoma Memorial. So they have separate events, separate but coordinated events that will recognize particular groups.
Family members, descendants of the sailors that were on board those craft.
Sure, they would exactly. Be. And that's very important. You know, the Oklahoma Memorial is also relatively new, but it is tremendously well supported. And of course, Oklahoma suffered a very significant loss of life also. But even more than that, you know, it centers around Pearl Harbor, but you have to remember this attack encompassed the entire island of Oahu, and Hickam Air Force Base was attacked, and the Air Force has a very moving ceremony there. Kaneohe, the Marine base on the windward side. Bellows, where the Japanese submarine, actually the miniature submarine, ran aground. It was attacked out in the center of the island. Wheeler Air Force Base, Schofield, the planes came right over there through the Koldikoli Pass and hit those aviation facilities. So you're going to see it from Pearl Harbor to the windward side to the center of the island and all the way out to Ewa, where the Marines actually had a base too, Ewa Marine Airfield. They didn't miss much, and of course they conducted actually two waves of attack and planned a third wave, but that they called off at the 11th hour. And we're not precisely sure why they called it. History would tell you that maybe the weather was deteriorating a little bit, or maybe they just thought that they'd had so much success and they'd lost so few aircraft and pilots that they wanted to husband their resources.
As I recall, there were aircraft that got in the air from other fields around the island in addition to Ford Island.
Yes, there were a number of aircraft that got into the air. When you see the movie Pearl Harbor that was made out here a number of years ago, about 15 years ago. It kind of centers around some of those pilots and aircraft that we're able to get in the air and have some success. But over half of the aircraft that we had on the island, and of course they were dispersed throughout a number of airfields, were destroyed in that attack. So there's some 45 or so events over this 8-9 day period. One very important event that I didn't get a chance to mention is the internment of two Arizona crewmen who have passed away in the last year. This is something that happens annually. And when you go out to the Arizona Memorial and you go in the Shrine Room, look at the lower left-hand side, and you'll see the names of all of the crew members who asked to have their ashes interred in Arizona when they died so that they could be buried with their shipmates. And that's probably one of the most poignant events or periods of time throughout this week.
Admiral, why were you personally selected to head up this program?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there's actually a precedent. At the 50th commemoration of the attack, one of my predecessors, Admiral Ron Hayes, was the chairman. Once again, that was a large event. We recognized it would attract a lot of national attention. So as this was being put together, folks at the different Pearl Harbor historic sites thought, well, we need somebody that, you know, isn't tied directly to us, but understands the community, understands the military, and, you know, has spent enough time here that has relationships that can help with all the different stakeholders here. So that's how I got invited to head the commemoration, and I'm certainly honored to do so. And the reason I bring up the community is because the community is a big part of this. And as we know, we lost some 2,000 service members during the attack, but there were another 400 folks, you know, some of which were civilians that died on December 7th. And of course, it impacted this community directly for the next 4.5 years, but really for their entire lives. And I think, you know, you and I were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, this place was blacked out afterwards. And it was a very abrupt change, because if you looked at the country right before the attack on Pearl Harbor, it was one of essentially isolationist sentiments. I mean, you look at the video of, you know, folks down on Waikiki, and it was a pretty good time for America in advance of that. We'd come out of the Depression, the economy was picking up, and nobody really wanted to get involved in another world war. You know, there were a lot of rumors. We just moved the Pacific Fleet from the West Coast out to Hawaii. But I think the general sentiment was that if there was an attack by the Japanese, it would probably be in the Far East somewhere, probably someplace like the Philippines. So this was a shock, and it changed people's lives abruptly, not just for a very short period of time, those 90 minutes where that attack occurred, but their lives going forward.
Even the nuances, that perfect storm Sunday morning, a different dynamic. It was Monday or Tuesday.
Metaphorically, you're right. I mean, you know, people always say, well, it was, you know, it happened at 7:55, so probably the sailors were asleep, or they were all on liberty. Well, that wasn't the case. You know, I mean, the reveille goes off 7 days a week on those Navy ships, and so most people were up and about, but it was Sunday. There were a lot of people ashore, you know, on leave or liberty or in their homes. So it was a quiet time, relatively, when that attack occurred.
All things said and done, there has to be a thematic thread that you envisioned when you put this together.
And we gave this a great deal of thought. I mean, we really talked about how we wanted to represent this to the nation. And so we came up with honoring the past and inspiring the future. And our thoughts were that certainly we wanted to honor this greatest generation and all those that served and sacrificed. And we recognize it was that war is a horrific event, and the sacrifice is just almost beyond imagination. And we really felt compelled to honor all who had served both at Pearl Harbor in World War II and even in Korea and Vietnam and so on. But equally important was taking this message to future generations. And so that's where we came up with Inspiring the Future. And there were a couple pieces of Inspiring the Future. One's the educational aspects of it, to make sure that future generations understand this history and sacrifice. But also, as I was talking earlier about it, the lessons of it. And also the reconciliation. You know, the fact that we went to war with Japan, but Japan is now one of our strongest allies, and not just an ally, a treaty ally. And of course, in my career, we exercised with the Japanese at sea frequently. I had great relationships with my Japanese counterparts, and so the reconciliation piece of this was also an element that we thought the American public, the international community, and of course future generations should know and understand.
There's that other dynamic that both our dads served as naval officers in World War II. And so in our lives, it's very close to us. We understand all those nuances, and we have to remind ourselves they're young guys in college, or this is distant history.
That's certainly true. And once again, that's why we put this emphasis on streaming the video from the December 7th ceremony out to all of these other sites. And we're putting different educational packages together that we can use and move them to schools, museums, all the places that will help preserve this history. And we're trying to get the kids involved that are coming to Hawaii. There's a whole group of bands that are coming to Hawaii. These kids are writing essays on Pearl Harbor and its place in history and what it means to them, things of that nature. So
this will make it tangible and palpable for them when they're there on location.
Absolutely. And they'll go home and they'll be able to speak to their experiences to a much wider set also.
I hope you don't mind diverting and going back in time. How did your journey start?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, I came from a Navy family, a long-standing Navy family. My father was a naval aviator in World War II. He actually flew P-2Vs originally and then was a test pilot and flew A-3s. He actually died in service when I was in the second grade. My mom was a Navy nurse in World War II. She went to Cal, went to Stanford Nursing School, and then she signed up and actually spent quite a bit of time in the Western Pacific and places like Guadalcanal.
Did they talk much about their World War II experiences with you?
A little bit. After my father was killed, my mother remarried 3 years later to another naval officer, Bill Fargo, who was a brave guy because he adopted the three kids, and that's how I became Tom Fargo. And he, of course, had seen a lot of action in World War II. He was on the battleship Arizona coming right out of the Naval Academy, spent about a year on the Arizona, and then he got orders for the new construction battleship USS Washington. So he spent the entire war on the USS Washington, started out as an ensign, and left as a lieutenant commander when the war was over. But they saw action in almost all of the major battles in the Pacific, including around Guadalcanal, Sabo Island, really an extensive amount of time. And he didn't really talk about it much until you poked and probed a little bit, like many in that generation.
So I imagine the Arizona was really poignant and close to his heart.
Well, it was. It was his first ship. And when I used to talk to him about his classmates, you know, that graduated with him at the same time in the class of 39, they almost all went to battleships. Most of those folks came right out of the Naval Academy, went to a battleship, and spent the war on one of those ships. Now, some may have later become naval aviators and so on, but that's how they all started. And of course, at that point in time, the battleships were very clearly the centerpiece of our naval power.
Were you ROTC, and how did you go active?
No, I went to the Naval Academy.
Oh, you did.
As I said, my father and my stepfather had gone to the Naval Academy. We actually were stationed at the Naval Academy when I was, just starting really elementary school. But I had an immediate affinity for it, and I made a determination early on that I wanted to go to the Naval Academy, and I was fortunate to be able to do so. So I had that background, and I think, like most people who went to the Naval Academy, you always think that you're going to be a pilot. You've seen the Blue Angels, and as I said, my father was a pilot. But I went and went down and immediately flunked the eye physical. I think I was 20, 35, and I kept reading the charts, and the guy said, quit squinting, and I said, I'm not squinting, and when he held my eyes open, it was pretty clear I was going to have to find something else to do. And so I looked around, and this is 1969, and it looked to me like the submarine force and kind of the center of the Cold War. The Soviets had built a very capable submarine force, and that looked to be one of the places that would be really an exciting place to spend my career.
So you went immediately shipboard as a submariner then?
Yeah, there's a little training we had to go through first. You know, as usual, there's nuclear power training and submarine training that are a part of the prerequisites before you go to your first submarine. But about 18 months after I was commissioned, I was on my first submarine, the USS Gannard in San Diego.
How did you evolve? How did you wake up one day an admiral? I mean, that's incredible.
Well, I think kind of one job at a time is the way you do it. I can remember the early days, I was just hoping to make a lieutenant. And I don't think anybody, you know, at that point in time in your career ever says, you know, I'm gonna be an admiral, at least not the people that probably end up being fortunate and being selected to flag rank. But, you know, I had a great career in the submarine force. I enjoyed it tremendously. As I said, it was right at the height of the Cold War, so it was exciting and rewarding. And I also had a number of opportunities to get to Washington, D.C. As a matter of fact, I ended up having 5 tours of duty in Washington, D.C. I'd go to Washington and I guess had some success, and that would allow me to go back to sea into the next job, and then you'd rotate back to Washington again. I worked for some fabulous leaders and, frankly, was very fortunate.
When did you go to work out the Pacific Fleet, and what did you do, and why did they bring you out here?
Well, I was actually stationed in Washington at the time as the director of operations and plans for the Navy. Once again, I was very fortunate, and the leadership of the Navy decided to make me a 4-star admiral, and my assignment was as commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet.
Amazing. Thomas Fargo, Admiral, United States Navy, retired. What an absolute honor and a true pleasure to spend the afternoon with you.
Well, thanks, Tom. It's been a great pleasure for me to get a chance to talk to you and understand that you're out here doing the kinds of things that I think are really important. I mean, you're going to visit all these historic sites, talk to the historians, the people that are making sure this fabulous history of our nation is properly preserved and projected to all those folks, both Americans and our international community, because it's hugely important.
I'm Tom Wilmer. We've been speaking with Thomas Fargo, Admiral, United States Navy, retired on the island of Oahu, Hawaii.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers include Melissa Corbin, Tennessee, Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas.